Tonight, I'm very happy to have Jisha Werner and Ken Sawyer here. Jisha, is this your third time speaking at Many Rivers?
I think it's
the third time. So she was one of our very first speakers, I think within the first 6 months. And Ken, this is your first time here.
Definitely my first time.
They are both Zen priests in the Soto Zen tradition, and they will be talking about this new book, which has just been published by Shambhala, Each Moment is the Universe, The Zen and the Way of Being Time by Dhanin Katagiri Roshi. I have not had a chance to read it, but Rob has had a chance to look at it. He says it's really wonderful, and I would expect nothing less from a project with which Jisha and Ken are associated. So thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
So we were going to start, I think, each talking a little bit about our relationship with Katagiri Roshi first, and then start reading from the book. I met Katagiri Roshi at the San Francisco Zen Center in 1969. I think we just decided he was 41 then. And he was one of three Japanese monk teaching assistants to Suzuki Roshi. We called sensei at the time, Katagiri sensei, Kobenchino sensei, and Yoshimura sensei. And it felt like a really rich time, you know, having these four people there who were really, you know, lovely teachers. And I think Suzuki Roshi used to give the Saturday talks, the public Saturday talks, and then the three of them would alternate doing the Wednesday night talks. Katagiri said to some, I can't remember who, to some friend of ours, he said that when he had to give his Wednesday night talk, he would be sick the whole day beforehand. And I think his English wasn't so good then. I think it was really difficult giving these lectures. You know, in Japanese, a one-hour lecture to 100 or 150 students was not easy for him. So I stayed in the city center for, I think, 6 months, and then went on to Tassajara, where I was there for the better part of two and a half years. And Katagiri was there most of that time. I'm not sure, maybe not so much of the summers, but he was there for all of the training periods. And I had this lovely little snapshot of sitting by the tea area, myself and some of the carpenters, waiting for lunch to happen. And noon service was about to happen. And we saw this procession coming along. This is the summertime at Tassajara. There was two women in bikinis. Katagiri Roshi in his black Zen robes, his attendant carried incense, and then two or three more women in bikinis behind. And we were giggling over there, and Katagiri looked over and he just gave us this wonderful, big, mischievous smile. I think they changed the rules at Tassajara about what guests wear. So he was there for most of those two or two and a half years. In the training periods, there was another monk, Tatsugami Roshi, who Suzuki Roshi had invited over from Japan, I think to sort of teach us and train us in the Japanese forms. And he was this sort of burly, sort of tough guy teacher the guest abbot. And Katagiri actually didn't do very much except translate for him during those two training periods. And Tatsugami would give these two and a half hour lectures, and Katagiri would have to translate for him. And he would talk for 40 minutes, and then Katagiri would have to translate for 40 minutes. And it looked really laborious, you know, we really felt for him. So then in December of 71, Suzuki Roshi died, and Katagiri stayed on just for one more training period. And although that was the first time actually that he was then the guest abbot, it was really his training period. And it was sort of wonderful to see, because he really, you know, I saw him in a totally different light. He had just been an assistant teacher up to that point. And at the end of that training period, he announced that he was leaving and going to Monterey to start a small group in Monterey. And I really loved him and didn't particularly love, at that time anyway, the incoming teacher, the new abbot, and so followed him to Monterey. And was lay ordained by him there. This is what you receive when you're lay ordained in our tradition. It's actually a miniature robe. And we were taught, we sewed them ourselves, and we were taught by his wife, Demoy, how to sew them. And then also, a couple of months later, Elizabeth here and I were married by him. And what stands out about that marriage ceremony was that he said, marriage is the crystallization of your delusions. Elizabeth's great aunt was there, and you heard this big sigh come out of her when he said that. But we found later that that was quite true. And then, though, so that was only, he was only there for about 8 months, and then he announced that he was moving to Minnesota. And he asked that none of us follow him there. And I'm sure if I had really decided to follow him there, that I could have, but anyway, that was what he had asked. And Elizabeth and I just decided together that we were, that Zen Center was kind of our home and we were going to stay on. So he left. I remember driving him to the airport, and he went off to Minnesota.
But I didn't meet him in Minnesota.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Okay.
I was living in Massachusetts, in rural Massachusetts, sitting on my own for years. And you read all these books, and they say, you should have a teacher. I said, all right, sit zazen. And then you read another book and says, you really should have a teacher. I say, oh, gurus, no, I don't want to. But after enough years and enough books, you say, well, maybe there's something to it. I like the books. Why am I picking and choosing someone? You know? Anyway, maybe I better look into it. And I went and sat with Sun Tzu in Providence. I sat with Philip Kaplow. I sat wonderful teachers. Most, and some of them, Bob Thurman was still in Amherst then, and he used to bring teachers in for a week or a weekend, and so I could come down out of my mountain fastness and my cabin in the woods and experience a teacher, and it was just wonderful. But none of them were, until he invited Katagiri. And I went and sat the weekend session, and I went right to Dokusan, and I said, what's the teacher-student relationship? And he said, the teacher carries the student on his back. I thought about it, and I said, well, does that mean I don't have to know how to do this? And he said, that's right. And I really liked him, but I still was a little bit leery of this business. And so I waited until the next, time they were having some event up in Minnesota, and went out to Minnesota to sniff out the people who were sitting with him. And they all seemed to have their feet on the ground and seemed to be more or less normal people, no, much less normal than I was, more or less normal people. And so I asked him to be my teacher. I listened to him. I spent the week. Actually, they had a workshop with him and Edo Shimano, who might also sat with a Rinzai teacher in New York. At the end of that week, it was really clear to me that this was someone I could work with as a teacher. And so I asked him to formally be my teacher because I was leaving, going 1,500 miles away, and I needed some sense of clarity. And that was it. And just before he died, about a month or two before he died, he had a last remission from his cancer. And Tomoy, ever hopeful, said, well, we need to get him out. We need to go out. And so he came over to my house for tea. Tejo brought him over for tea. I was part of Tejo and I, Munich and I, were his sort of his core caregivers. And damned if he didn't remember meeting me that time at Hampshire College 10 years before. Because Tejo said, oh, do you remember that? I told him that. He said, no, I don't remember that, but I remember he remembered our encounter and smiling at each other. And I remember that moment, too. He was so I received nothing. I was telling Ken, I received nothing from him except his teaching. No raksu, no precepts. I sewed my robes to be ordained as a priest, and then he went to Japan. He said, I'll ordain you when I come back. Went to Japan on sabbatical, came back with cancer, took care of him. So he said, oh, someone will take care of it. He does. But his teachings, I got his teachings, I got his heart, I got to practice with him closely for 10 years. I used to commute from Massachusetts to Minnesota. It's kind of a long commute. But he had built the seasonal monastery, and I'd go for a month, go for 2 months, go for 3 months. And then 1 year, following him around the Kinhin porch during the practice period, I said to myself, if you really want to get what this man has to offer, maybe you'd better do it his way. And I went and asked him about ordaining. And he said, well, how about moving to Minneapolis? I said he wanted to ordain me, no promises, but how about moving to Minneapolis? So I left the beautiful timber frame house I built on 12 acres in Massachusetts and all my friends, moved to Minnesota, practiced with him there. Helped bury him there. You know, the first book he wrote, Returning to Silence, came out during his life. And I worked on that one. And it's a beautiful book, straight from the heart. Practically on his deathbed. I was the vice president, and so president and I were sitting and asking him the last couple of questions, and I said, how about more books? I was an editor, so that's how I supported my Zen training. And I said, well, do you want more books? He said, yes. I want Zen Center to hold my be in charge of my writings, and I want more books, but I want you to edit me more. And so a second book was made. I worked on it some, and then not, because I was by then training and ordaining and with another teacher and going to Japan, where I received this rakusu from my only female teacher. And now finally this book, which was edited by Andrea Martin, who was with whom I practiced there under Katagiri. She was a close student of his. And she was a lay student. Some were priests, some were lay. He didn't care. I mean, he cared in terms of what you did and the practice you did and who was Eno or who was what position you held. It didn't matter. But he did have this strong sense that you could throw your life into the Dharma. And the best way to do that was to let the Dharma be a container for your whole life. And that was what I tried to follow him with. And so this book is really quite a wonderful book. It's coherent, and it's beautiful. And it has very deep teaching. And it kept sounding to me like Katagiri. He was a very warm-hearted man. He would start out sitting like this. Session, his mouth was like this. And if you went to Dokusan, the practice interview was very formal. You went in the room and you did three formal prostrations and you turned aside the cushion around and you faced him. And there was his face. And it usually took me 5 minutes to get it to go like this. We would be off and he was very serious, but his smile was as big as the world.
You see it right here.
Yeah, we had.
I don't even see it from that distance, but
we
this is his sweet
just
smile.
Before he went on his sabbatical, we said, "You got us a still, and let us get some pictures of you." And we got someone who could handle a camera better than the rest of us to take pictures. I have this picture on my altar, or one from that series on that morning. Yeah, and he died. He was only 62 when he died. Pretty young. It's very hard to choose to live in exile. To choose to live in a foreign place and to be trying to bring forward your background, your life, the Dharma, and on the ground you know to stand it on in a place where there's only you. I mean, he moved to Minnesota. There was nothing but Katagiri and the Lutherans. There was no Buddhism except Katagiri, I think, in 71 in Minnesota. It was difficult. Buddhism is really hard, he says. And then he would say, Buddhism is really hard, but we're always walking hand in hand in Buddha's world. He wasn't from a priest family, unlike most Japanese priests. His father ran a little restaurant, and they're ordinary folk, and they were Pure Land Buddhists, devotional Buddhists. And every month the priest would come to the house and chant sutras at the family altar. They still Zen, Pure Land, they all do that. I've done that there. And he was so impressed as a little boy by this figure. He really wanted to be just like him. And so when he was 5 or 6, he would take the little stubs of incense out of the incense station, put them in his pocket, and eat them for snacks. He was wholehearted in his pursuit of the way. So I would like to read a little bit and say how it struck me. And one of the pieces that struck me from this book was from the very beginning. Where he speaks simply, and he speaks in some ways simply through most of it. He gets a little less simple in his language later in the book, but simple goes very deep, and sometimes simple is very clear. So he says, spiritual life originates from the direct observation of impermanence. You don't have to be upset and try to escape when you realize that time constantly cuts off your life, because there's another aspect of time. One aspect of time is to separate. The other is to connect. The aspect of time that separates you from others is the human world. The aspect of time that connects you to others is universal truth. You're connected with all beings in time, which permeates into every inch of the cosmic universe and space, where everyone and everything exists in peace and harmony together. So you are you, but you don't exist alone. You are connected with others, to dogs, cats, trees, mountains, the sky, stars, Dogen, and Buddha. I think this whole book is his answer to how am I going to live my life? And where will I stand up? And what is it to be me? And what is it to be me, and how come I'm suffering? And what am I going to do about it? And how come you're suffering? And what am I going to do about it? Can I do anything about any of it? I just came from a practice period where in turn I was teaching some priests in the Soto tradition in Ango, and one of them felt that she was really going to end suffering. And she felt she was 90% of the way there. And bless her strong and dogmatic heart, she's got some learning to do, but the heart behind that, I want to end suffering. So we start out experiencing this separateness. And we experience ourselves as suffering, and we identify our separateness and our suffering, and we see how we're cut away from others and cut away from ourselves and cut apart, and things, life keeps jerking along and pulling the rug out, and things keep ending, and we don't like that, and why should we? So hoping that there's something more, that's our first turning of our Dharma wheel. First, that's just how it is, and we grope and we churn and we rush along. Then at some point we say, well, is this really how it is, or am I not getting it? Is there something more to get? That's our first opening, our first turning toward trying to find a way to understand something bigger. So we seek relief from this separation, and we say, well, okay, I'm not going to go for denial. That's the drugs, sex, power. That's one way to try to find relief from facing the fact that I feel separated and in pain. So I'm not going to do that. And so we find a way that says, oh, there is something more. And we go towards something more that tries to show us that there's continuity, that there's a flow, that there is more than separate individualness. That time can connect us. That there's something, maybe there's even something universal that can connect us and connects this and connects that. And maybe it can, if it isn't going to be my special little province just connecting me, maybe it connects everything. And then we have something universal. I wanted for so many years, especially the years when I was practicing under Katagiri, to live in this universal truth Buddha's world where everything is connected, and not live in a world of separation. And we resolve to awaken and to live awake. And to live awake to us means living in this sense of connectedness, because we know the suffering and pain of separation. Katagiri is saying here, separation is part of time. It's not separation in endings are bad, universal connectedness is good. He's saying that's not enough. Which is why I think the beginning of his book is very, very powerful and very important. I wouldn't want to skip over it. One aspect of time separates the moment. The moment ends. The moment keeps ending. It ends and it ends and it ends. And it arises and it arises and it arises and it ends. And this is takes place in bodies, and bodies have limits. And he's saying that it's not enough, it's not complete when we understand, no matter how deeply we move toward understanding a universal connectedness of time and truth and us one to the next. This is our world of, we see this as our world of interdependence, which is not separate from the world of impermanence. We say, okay, I can get impermanence's flow, it keeps moving. Impermanence is also ending, endless endings, the moment. He's saying this is time. This is not separate from our understanding of time as a universal truth of flow. But we can't just turn away from that. And it's each moment is the universe. Not because it isn't each moment. It's exactly because it's a moment that it's also the universe. It's exactly because we're each a particular body, particular here, particular now, that the universe arises. I think it's very important. Having the two aspects of separation and connection is called impermanence. It's called moment. This is the original nature of time. Not just the one side that we go to because we know separation is suffering. The whole thing is the universal truth of time. The whole thing is impermanence. The whole thing is your life. This is the original nature of time, where you understand the one place called the domain of impermanence, where you live alone and at the same time live together with all beings and peace and harmony. This is spiritual security. Then you understand what a human being is. As long as we turn away from a kind of deep or radical acceptance of ourselves separate beings, will be participating in the war. You know, all it's very popular now. Richard Dawkins and a whole bunch of people, Hutchins, writing books about religion is the worst thing in the world. This is, you know, just Marx said the same thing too. My parents said the same thing. First thing I ever did was become a Buddhist for my poor parents, let alone a priest.
We both had Marxist parents.
Yeah, I was a red diaper baby. You did. Hey, look, a bunch of pair of failures. Only when we can take that universal truth and locate it in moments that actually end and arise and end and arise in bodies that have actual limitations, that we can end the war. And when
can you say
we
say that again, please? Can you repeat that?
Probably not.
How do we end the war?
Only when we, I call it radical acceptance. When we radically accept that it's in this individual, limited, personal body coming, stopping, ending, and with its limitations and its boundaries, that universal life and universal truth come up, and it's only in this kind of body that I can awaken, that there can be compassion. Compassion is the action of limited bodies. Wisdom coming out of limited bodies. It's only when my understanding of universal truth comes up out of the individual, limited body, living moment after moment, that I can end the war. Something like that. So, I think I want to stop a little here. Maybe just
so
pause for a
why
moment.
Why don't I read a couple of things and say a few things, but then there's that one...
Yeah, we were comparing notes yesterday on the phone. Well, which passages do you want to read, Ken? And he said, well, I want to read this passage on 53. This passage on page 79. And this passage on 51. I said, oh, no, that's a little too high one. So we figured we'd have different things to say about it. And it's one about... it's a passage about suffering.
And we sort of felt like it tied it all together. So one of us will read that at the end.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, good. I want to say one thing that, you know, this is, you know, we can, in some way, to read something like this, when someone is describing Buddhism, there's a philosophical and intellectual, you know, side to it. But it really comes from, you know, the experience of meditation. You know, this came from Buddha's experience of meditation and Katagiri's experience of meditation and Dogen's experience of meditation. So I want to read a couple of things here first. First from Katagiri, when he's talking about sitting zazen, he said, settle on yourself as if your body and mind were a huge building rising toward the sky from your round cushion. Open your mind again and again to see what impermanence means. And then Suzuki Roshi, so for a period of time each day, try to sit in shikantaza is kind of our most basic Soto Zen meditation practice. Without moving, without expecting anything, as if you were in your last moment. Moment after moment, feel your last instant. In each inhalation and each exhalation, there are countless instants of time. Your intention is to live in each instance. So I'm going to be in here. Time seems to be separate from beings, but actually there is no separation. From moment to moment, all sentient beings exist together as a completely independent moment of time. When the moment begins, all sentient beings temporarily appear as particular beings in the stream of time and seem to have their own separate existences. When the moment ceases, all sentient beings disappear, but they do not go away. They are interconnected smoothly and quietly in timelessness. Dogen's word being represents all sentient beings existing in the formless realm of timelessness. And time characterizes the existence of completely independent moments. Being and time work together, so Dogen doesn't separate them. He uses the one term, being time. And this notion of being time is one and the same thing. I think, I mean, I don't know if it's true of everyone, but I've always had the sense that time was something separate, something that was the background in which, you know, in front of which the whole world, you know, moved. And but when I thought about this a little bit, I thought, but what could time be other than being? What could it be other than the movement of being? Can you imagine what it could be? Is it something separate from that? Or how could it be anything other than the constant movement or changing of being? And then I want to read. And this is one that I just think is beautiful. And this is a real category thing here. Mind arousing time means, that relates to, I won't go into what led into this, but when conditions are arranged and the time is right, timelessness appears. At that time, forms appear as formlessness, trees are treelessness, Katagiri is Katagirilessness, and Zazen is Zazenlessness. Real time comes up with no gap, and Zazen is a wonderful being, creating cushions, people sitting next to each other, the sound of cars, all completely as one. 12-hour time never leaves its own trace. 12-hour time is, you know, our usual sense of time, or the human world. Never leaves its own trace, it just becomes timelessness. That is arousing time. So I just thought this was like poetry, you know. And I love this idea here of that Zazen is a wonderful being, creating cushions, the sound of cars, people sitting next to each other, all completely as one. The idea, that Zazen is, I guess, in this sense of a world where there is no separation, everything can arise as a being. You know, our thoughts arise as a being. Everything in the phenomenon or new inner world can arise as a being. But this idea of Zazen as arising as a being and creating this space, this oneness. So those are the two things I wanted to read. And then we have this last one.
When
here.
You said category as is categorylessness, you know, what it reminded me of was, you see, when we're home with our own students, we're kind of, I'm not all that serious, but we're fairly serious because, you know, they're going to come back next week and say, what did you mean by that? But when you're away from home, you sometimes get a little loose. So when he was in Kingston, Massachusetts, he was being a little loose. And he told stories. And he told the story about Tomoe chopping her tip of her finger off in the emergency case of life. But he told another story, which was about his big enlightenment experience at Tassajara and categorylessness. Ah! So as he told, and I later got some, you know, other details as I ferreted them out in my way once I was in Minnesota. It seems that during one of those angos at Tassajara, Katagiri had a major enlightenment experience. Mm. And he said, at the time when we were giving, he was talking that during that session, he said for days he was transported. It was that timelessness, that Katagirilessness. And then after about a week, he said, Stinky Katagiri was back. That's what he called it. It was Stinky Katagiri. And he had to learn to accept that it wasn't. Then that took years, I think, to say, there's this. Because we tend to say, oh, there's this. That's a danger. We don't like enlightenment experiences. We love them. But, you know, they're a great trap. They're a great. It can be like a drug, an addiction. There's this wonderfulness. And then Stinky Katagiri. So I want to get back to that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He got with Stinky Katagiri.
It might have been that last training period where I said, you know, he was the leader of the he was really the abbot for that training period.
It was when Suzuki Roshi was still alive.
Oh,
because
oh.
A story I got about it later from Minnesota was that, and he corroborated some of this, that Suzuki Roshi, of course, he told Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi sent to Japan and got him a Satori certificate. Kid you not? That's the trouble with our great tradition has this, you know, churchy side. So they sent a Satori certificate, and he burned it in his wood stove in Tassajara. They've got all kinds of things. I'm a missionary to the heathen. Japan. They have all kinds of ideas. We all have notions. But the notions of another culture seem particularly funny to us.
When we were at Tassajara, the Soto headquarters sent a plaque over. And in Japanese, it said Official Soto Zen Center or Zen Practice Place. And he looked at it and he gave it to me and asked me to put it in the firewood.
The two of them were in accord in many ways. Many, many ways.
Yeah. But that last training period, he had us sit three sesshins. It was a, you know, 2.5 month. A sesshin is, for those of you who don't know, is an intensive 1 week, you know, period of meditation where we sit from like 4 o'clock in the morning until 9 at night. And usually the training period ends with one at the end of the training period, but he had to sit, that was his last training period, and he had to sit three sesshins that training period.
I guess you knew he was leaving and you couldn't give him too much grief about it.
So, do you want to read that last? This is the one that we thought sort of pulled this all together.
It is important to deeply understand human suffering because suffering and pain never go away. Stinky Katagiri never goes away. The more you practice spiritual life, the more you realize this. The more you try to live in peace and harmony, the more you see how egotistical and selfish you are. The deeper you go, the more you see the minute vibration of suffering coming up from the depths of your heart. Even though you attain enlightenment, suffering and pain are still there in your life. But that's all right. Just like everything that exists in the phenomenal world, your suffering is a being that arises from the original nature of existence, and every moment it returns to its source. So when you see suffering, all you have to do is accept it and offer your body and mind to ultimate existence. Then you and suffering return to emptiness, and there is freedom from suffering. If you see the total dynamic functioning at the pivot of your life, the place where all aspects of human life unfold, there's no confusion, no suffering, and you can live freely in the stream of time. And that's not apart from living as a being with suffering. Yeah. That's what the young, ardent young priest didn't get. She thought that it would end and then it's over. But that's not the way. That's our old idea about moment and ending. And if moments ending and ending and ending and arising are the expression of this flow of universal truth, then things aren't over.
Now, this is the most beautiful sort of thing I read about suffering. But I mean, when you first study Buddhism, you study the Four Noble Truths, and there's an end to suffering. And I thought, gee, I can go to the Zen Center and study Buddhism for, who knows, a month or 2 months or a few years, and suffering will be over. And it isn't over, and yet it is over. You know, I mean, this is, I love the way, you know, it arises and ceases, it arises and ceases. There's an opportunity in every moment.
Could you read that again?
Yeah. Read it again? Why don't you read it now?
Okay. It is important to deeply understand human suffering because suffering and pain never go away. The more you practice spiritual life, the more you realize this. The more you try to live in peace and harmony, the more you see how egotistical and selfish you are. The deeper you go, the more you see the minute vibration of suffering coming up from the depths of your heart. It is true in every religion. If you pray to God with sincerity, you still suffer. Even though you attain enlightenment, suffering and pain are still there in your life. But that's all right. Just like everything that exists in the phenomenal world, your suffering is a being that arises from the original nature of existence, and every moment it returns to its source. So when you see suffering, all you have to do is accept it and offer your body and mind to ultimate existence. Then you and suffering return to emptiness, and there is freedom from suffering. So here he's talking about suffering as a being. I remember earlier he was talking about Zazen as a being, and here he's talking about suffering as a being.
If you notice that our sound are a little different, it's because I edited mine. Well, I've always edited all my teachers. I took a little sentence out here, and I moved one in from another part of the book. So never alike, never the same twice.
This is a collection of lectures, actually, that Katagiri Roshi gave over a period of, what,
20 years.
Cause some of them from when he was in Zen Center, even, so 25 years or so, and that Andrea put together quite wonderfully, I think.
I think if we take that moment and ending, and not only the gap of confusion, not only the gap of suffering, that we could think we want to end. They are the real life in Buddha's world. But you know what? When we this, and then he would say, "This sweet, my sweet, sweet man," with sweetness and gentleness, he would then say, "Please shut up and sit down." Mm-hmm. When the words get too much, as always, please shut up and sit down. Do zazen.
I also remember, he used to say, if you have to die, please die. Did he say
die whole, die completely.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. One of the things I discovered, and only really in the last few years, was that, you know, I really settled my life in the Dharma life. Sort of turned my life over to the Dharma. The Dharma, like a sense of being the Dharma, almost like pontoons. The Dharma extends around me, and I'm I'm in and supported by the Dharma. And then it went away. And then I lost that. Big, my life turned upside down and I lost that. Well, did that mean that my practice was inadequate? Did that mean that Dharma was inadequate? Certainly didn't mean that Dharma was inadequate. Maybe my practice was inadequate. My practice is inadequate. That didn't seem to answer it either. You know, it's always it was no more inadequate than it had always been. Was the Dharma not sort of big enough, or my practice big enough to answer to the time when your life really turns over? And then I realized that when we experience our experience of this connectedness or of being supported or being in Buddha's world is how now in this moment I'm experiencing Dharma. And this moment will end. And so the way I experience Dharma will end. And I have to drop that and stay quiet like a small, you know, like an animal that's hunting, almost, that's watching. Do this kind of open and watchful for whatever might come along. And I discovered that the Dharma was still there coming up, but not in the same way. Because the circumstances had changed. That moment had ended when my life had a certain kind of continuity. So it became up different, but it was still there coming up. The deep in the ground, the world of truth was still flowing, but it came up in different ways. And I could have to allow that it won't always look the same. Our idea of what's universal truth, our idea of connection, our idea of flow will carry us a long way, but we have to be willing to let it go, let it end, and not think that it's the Dharma that's ending or our life that's ending or our world that's ending. The moment is ending. Dharma's still there. We're still there. Another moment comes up. And then you can see this moment where moment ending is seems so terrible is actually just a moment of life coming up. But it won't always look the same. I guess that's for category. It was discovering stinky category.
Yeah. This made me realize I only saw him occasionally from the time he left Zen Center and moved to Minneapolis. Maybe every two or three years I saw him. He'd come out and visit. He'd come out to visit and he'd spend a week or so and I'd see him. But reading this book really made me realize how much he matured and developed as a teacher during those years after he left the Zen Center.
And he wanted to do this. He wanted to do this from the very get-go. Folkways, I think it was, has a Sounds of Aheiji done in the 50s, and he was the guy up on the roof, up in the roof tiles and in the attic, putting out the microphones. It's in there was a Zen book. What was her name? Woman who ran someone who went and wrote a book in the about her experience in the 50s and 60s, and there was Katagiri trying to place the microphones for the chant recording that would go to the stage and trying to practice his lousy English even then. He wanted to get away in the worst way. He wanted to come here. Not so much to get away as to come here. And he wanted to go somewhere where he could really practice Zen. And, but like all of these, Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, teacher Toznakiyama, Koben Chino, they were all inspired by their life in a Japanese monastery because that was where they had a true Zen. And so what they brought here was a very monastic form of Zen. And so we're translating that in our bodies into something that works in all of our lives that's neither the monastic Zen of Japan, although that's available as one way. There are many moments, many bodies, but that isn't just what else they do in Japan, which is sort of a temple Buddhism. So we're still figuring out, what's this? Do we want to do a sishin? Do we want to do some other form of... And at the heart of it, there's still this basic deep practice we call shikantaza, or just sitting, where all you're doing is being here in this moment with your whole life. And it's never done. So it's not just, you know, letting things, thoughts flow or arriving in the moment. We don't know what that moment is. We can always keep finding it out. Always keep finding it out. Always come home to it. It's always there. Until we die.
So the shikantaza is usually defined as a particular sitting practice, but actually it's our whole life. Suzuki Roshi always talked about shikantaza as being our whole life.
Wholeheartedness.
Yeah.
And they both were were full of that. So I highly recommend the book. Time is up, and we're time. So I think it's time to hear from somebody else.
Who was Katagiri's Dharma heir?
He gave transmission when he was very ill with cancer, and his life was clearly going to be cut off. A couple of abbots of monasteries in Japan came to help give. He gave transmission to 12 priests. 11 of them were ones he had ordained, and one was, or 10 were his ordained, and two others. Yvonne was the only one. Yvonne ran from San Francisco Zen Center, and the others were. I don't think any of them are teaching in California, teaching in the Midwest, teaching in the East, not teaching, writing books. Steve Hagen, who edited one of the books, was one of them. So he wanted them to be able to have that affirmation, that validation to go on with.
I remember him physically because there was such an ectomorphian tradition with male Zen priests that I noticed when I first got to Zen Center in the early 80s. And Katagiri would show up, and he always had his sleeves, they were shorter or something. He'd pull them up, and he had these little ham-fisted arms. And he was just like, football player Zen something. And I appreciated that so much. One, because of the contrast. It seemed like it was so much more body-based than head intellectual based. And the other thing, I never could understand him very well, even in the 80s.
Yeah.
So the body did the talking. You know,
right.
I felt he would struggle so hard with the English. I really appreciated the fact that just watching him and sitting with him was so much. Gave spoke volumes, you know, beyond what he was able to actually articulate.
I did hear that the first time he gave a talk at San Francisco Zen Center, put his whole body and his whole self and his whole life into it for an hour, and then no one could understand a word he said. but it's, if you were there every day, you know, we would attune to his ear, and then he would love words and vocabulary, and he would pick up new words, and sometimes he didn't get them quite right, but he would carry on with the word. He went for a whole session talking about pudgy wudgy. Everyone would look to me, you know, the editor. Come on. Pudgy-wudgy. Finally, I realized he was talking about hodgepodge. He would come up with words and throw them in. But his English was... his vocabulary was great. His grammar left a lot to be desired.
I remember Sashin when I was a very young student in the 70s, and somebody had come to Zen Center, a young couple with a baby. And they left their baby in their room, and they came to the baby's ill, and they came to the sashin, and the baby died. And you know, none of us knew who these people were because everybody comes in their own way. They weren't regular students. I didn't ever know who they were. But and they decided that it was kind of sort of a fake. They had this idea if they came to sashin and sat zazen and were perfect
that they would save their baby,
would heal the baby. So he was furious, and again, I didn't know who he was talking about. He was talking about stubbornness of ego. He said, this isn't practice, this is stubbornness of ego.
Yeah,
that's right. It was very powerful because it must have impacted him greatly to be responsible for that group and have somebody come and do something as dangerous. To think that way is very dangerous. You know, somebody's life is given up because of that kind of thinking. And I mean, they meant well.
It's so hard for us to know when it's stubbornness of ego and when it's meeting life as it is with something, some strength.
Heartfelt, yeah.
I just remembered a quote from his previous book where he said, you should accept the whole universe as the contents of your life. The universe accepts you as the contents of your life, so why can't you accept the whole universe as the contents of your life?
The universe accepts you.
Yeah, right.
Why can't you accept the universe? Right. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two books.
Regarding the paradox between separation and unity, I like looking at language and words and sentences and how, and at the movement from the beginning of a sentence to the end, and how each word gives, kind of surrenders its life to the word that's going to come after it, and the vision that it takes to get from the beginning to the end of the sentence, and how that vision holds each word as it's carried along.
That's beautiful. See, we see the word is sort of like is that moment of separation. It has a beginning and an end, and the universe is seamless, and they were chopping it up in little pieces called words. But also the words turn us toward seeing, and the words, I like that, it surrenders itself to the next to build meaning and coherence. We wouldn't know how to be without words.
Yeah, and somehow the relationship between the words is held in the vision of the sentence. Somehow, yeah, it's mysterious. It's wonderful.
So some of us were reading together with Ken at our, we have a little zendo in Occidental called Back Porch Zendo. We were reading this with Ken and one of the students there was feeling like kind of perplexed by Katagiri's style. But these last three sentences, including the one that you shared and the two that Ken read, kind of pitched us all out of our heads, you know. At first hearing, I thought, I have no idea what he said. I can't string any of this together. It's kind of throwing me out into a non-conceptual ocean. But then by the time we got to the sentence that you read together, it pulled us all together in some kind of, it's like a pivotal, something similar. It strung everything together and made us grounded. And we stopped feeling at loose ends or unhappy with how he expresses himself. It just seemed like it all just kind of clicked. And I felt like, oh, Katagiri Roshi must have gotten enlightened. Because he kind of snapped us all there. It was kind of great.
And the book will do that. If it one page it gets...
That was it,
the next page, it gets really clear and comes together because he was...
I feel like I keep going back and forth and reading this and thinking, I don't understand this stuff. And then the next minute I think, God, I feel this in my bones, you know? And then again, I go back, I don't understand it. I thought tonight, how can I talk about this here? I don't understand this stuff. And yet when I go through it, I just love it. And I, as I said, I kind of feel it in my bones.
When I was down teaching at this training period for training priests, there was a young man, terribly earnest, not terribly, wonderfully earnest, and who really wants to get Dogen and really doesn't get it. And Dogen is a very, very difficult philosopher, a great founder of Soto Zen in Japan. And so this young man, he's been practicing for 10 years, been ordained for 5, and he can't get, and he's been working at this, so you get to feel pretty stupid after a while. You can't get it. And so I assured him that... It had taken me 20 years to get him too, but that it's like that first, I would listen to Katagiri. First, I didn't understand anything about the Dogen. He'd be talking about Dogen. I couldn't understand a word of it, but I could kind of make sense of some of Katagiri's words. And then eventually I could make sense of Katagiri's words and have a sense what he was talking about, and it'd be a little glimmer and it would be gone. And that was, each of those is a decade. And then the next decade, you know, so we have to hang around. We have to keep coming back. And then then there's more, and then that sense of getting it seeps into our bones, and then sometimes it actually becomes very clear. And then the clarity goes away because that moment ends too.
So Suzuki Roshi used to say to young students, when I heard him say, when we were very young, most of us, that if you can understand it with your skin,
yeah.
If you don't understand it with your mind, just you will understand it. You can understand it with your skin.
for all the things, Katagiri was a very main formative teachers. I've had four teachers, all Japanese. And no one is a good teacher for everyone. It's impossible. And he wasn't a good teacher for everyone. But he was a good teacher for me, and for all his, well, the sweetness and the heartfulness were very good because I was very intellectual. I would go, first years, I would bound out to Minnesota and say, and I've been reading Nishitani, the great philosopher, and I've been reading, and he would say, well, reading a few books is good. But then when I moved out there, he made me education coordinator, so I guess it was all right then. So then it was all right. One moment it's not the right thing, another moment it is. But in the end, what made him the right teacher for me, the good teacher for me, was that he didn't pull back from my stinkiness. He didn't come toward and he didn't pull back. Well, he came toward as with his human heart, but he wouldn't come toward and he didn't pick and choose. But he, most of all, he didn't recoil. And I had all kinds of recoilable stuff. It was pretty, and I still have plenty of recoilable stuff. You know, this projecting and wanting to be the perfect student and wanting this and wanting it. He didn't let it bother him. He didn't hold it against me. And to find someone who doesn't hold it against you allows you to accept it and drop it. It's very precious for me, that way.
I have a question for Ken.
Yeah.
When Katagiri left Monterey or California, why do you think he went completely across the country? Was it kind of like a seamless plan?
Oh, there was there was a group there already which invited him to come, and I think maybe they've been asking him for some time.
Oh, in Minnesota.
They went out.
Yeah, in Minnesota.
They've been asking him, and he didn't say anything, so two of them made the trip to California to ask him to come. They said, we will support you. They were young, and they said, one said, I will dedicate my entire salary as a clinical psychologist. I'm young, my husband's got a job. You will be supported. He had a wife, and I think already one.
Two already?
Yeah, before, both of them were born before
the two
he moved.
Boys, yeah, they were. Yeah. Okay. Yes, they were.
So he had responsibilities, but he also wanted to have his own, a place that he could develop.
That's kind of interesting. He didn't want anybody to come with him, though.
That's what that piece is. He didn't want to take them away from there. He didn't want to destabilize what was there.
Yeah, maybe that was it. It was such a flaky group.
Which is, I'm sure, part of why he left, too.
There were a couple of times when it was just he and I were the only ones there in the morning, and I would do the bells and the chanting and everything.
I think it would be considered by a Japanese person very bad form to take students away from your monastery that took care of you for a while.
Yeah.
And when Richard Baker came, it was kind of like, they both couldn't stay there comfortably. So when he left, I think he didn't think it was polite or correct to invite Hiroshi students and potentially Baker
just didn't go. Right. If someone had felt it was really what they wanted to do and they had to do, I wouldn't have said no. Because later a couple of people did move out. But
That's right.
Yeah. The story that I heard about Katagiri that really impressed me was that he was carrying Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi was very sick with cancer to the Mount Sea ceremony. Were you there? And
he was carrying him?
Katagiri was carrying Suzuki Roshi because Suzuki Roshi was so weak.
Yeah.
But Katagiri was feeling so much grief that he could barely walk.
Wow.
He was in such a state of grieving. Somebody told me this story. I don't know if it's true, but
I don't know.
But I thought to myself at that time, wow, that's really it. To be, like you were talking about, not recoiling.
Yeah.
Going towards it.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, how is that different from just being completely attached and admired
and stuff? He wailed, too. He wailed in the ceremony, Mountain Sea ceremony. Suzuki Roshi was stepping down and installing Richard Baker. Katagiri just wailed. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it was really beautiful.
Suzuki Roshi was actively dying.
When Katagiri Roshi was sick with his cancer, because he lived about a year with it, he went through chemo after chemo for the sake of trying to continue for his students, but his teaching, he didn't come down and teach. He didn't make a presentation of any kind. He was a little guy in pajamas upstairs fighting to continue for his students, and went, oh God, Tomoy, when it would get bad. They were going to, natural remedies. He was drinking raw grated potato juice if someone asked him to do something, he would do it. But his teaching that point was sort of the opposite of that. Was this, I'm just a little guy in pajamas, except when he had to do the Dharma transmission sermon, he had to be carried. I didn't know if he had carried. He had to be carried. Because he was too weak to stand up, too weak to come downstairs, almost too weak to sit in the seat to do some of the ceremonies. There are all kinds of teachings.
There's a picture in the book, Return to Silence, of Katagiri. It's a really animated picture of him. He looks like he's so vibrant. I mean, it's just a fantastic photo.
He looks like he was so what?
Vibrant.
Vibrant. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Phenomenal picture of him. You talk about the smile.
Yeah.
And it's...
Yeah. And he probably may have had this kind of muscular body, but kind of a taut, energetic body, but he was very graceful. And so we all thought that's how a Zen master is. And then after he died, and I became I went to see my new teacher, my new Tozen. I'd known him for some time, but it was the first time I'd been in his center. I guess it was before we really formed the definite plan of my training with him. And he was upstairs, and he came down the stairs, and I breathed a sigh of relief. He would drop things. He still does it. He would lose things. When I was away in Japan one time, he was leading Sesshin at Stone Creek, and he sat down to give the talk in Ohatsu and then said, "Oops, excuse me," jumped up and ran out of the room because he'd forgotten his notes.
Yeah.
So there was the other side of, and it wasn't that Katagiri felt you had to be just so, but there's on the one hand, someone is very graceful, on the other hand, they're very ordinary. And for me, it was very helpful to have a teacher who didn't have so much of a persona of that.
Yeah.
There's more room for me. Yeah.
When I lived at Zen Center for a short time, and then I went away and studied yoga with a teacher named Baba Haridas, who's at Mount Madonna now. And when I came back to Zen Center, Katagiri and his wife Tomoe heard that I did yoga, so they asked me to leave Sasahara and come to their house and teach yoga. And I was kind of new. I've been doing it for a while, but I wasn't really a teacher, and I didn't exactly know how to teach. And I think I was being too laborious, and too—I'm not sure—but I think I was just being too rote. And at some point, they just started acting like little dogs and barking at each other, playing, ignoring me.
How is Tomoe, and how
is
her health?
Of course, she's doing fine. She still teaches sewing some. She lives in Minneapolis, where she has a grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
It's the joy of her life.
Yeah.
And teaches sewing from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But she's energetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's well. So, are there any last thoughts or comments? Teachers and students. That's kind of what when we wound up with. Let's see.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So, can I make my announcement too? Which is Stone Creek Zen Center of Sebastopol is temporarily in Forestville for a year or two. And of course, did I bring a brochure? Did I bring a schedule? No. StoneCreekZenCenter.org has directions and schedule. But yes, here we have our annual Christmas holiday. This is our big fundraiser of the year. The Masonic Hall, the first Saturday of December, will be December 1st, 9 to 4.
Oh, that's you.
Okay. Yes, that's us. That's us. It's everything goes to the Zendo. Everything. There's no booths and all the everything anyone buys or does there goes to support the Zendo. We usually serve a sushi lunch. This year it's going to be sushi and oden, which is a traditional Japanese winter soup, which I'm taking charge of making. We have a silent auction. We have a raffle. We have a wonderful raffle. Raffle tickets are here. Rummage, crafts, gifts, grapes, zafus, incense. Beautiful. We have a beautiful garden, the size hand-cast Jizo statue this year. It's really quite stunning. all kinds of. Oh, and then there's the art project. We always have a it's usually, and this year again, the prayer flags for peace flags. So we just supply the flags and stamps and things, and anyone wants to come, children, old and young, and make a set of flags and take them away. There's no fee. It's just a
wonderful.
Oh, and our jams. We got about we sell about 300
jams.
Yeah, jams. Barton made blackberry.
We picked.
Dave Hazelwood made his apple butter from the apples he grows. And it's fun.
It's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
And any of you who live up by Occidental, if you ever want to join us, we have a little Tuesday night sitting group at our place in Occidental.
At one half-day sitting and afters for.
Do you have a web?
We can get you know, Elizabeth.
We don't have a website. I'm the contact person. I can
so if you're interested in the Occidental group.
And I think I'm on your list.
And you're on our list.
On the list of groups, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Am I on your list of groups?
Yes.
Yes. Do I go? Do I remember to go to the website? I barely got up, but we did get a website phone.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you.
That was wonderful. It was really beautiful. And thank you, everybody, for attending. Annie Rivers Books and Tea has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, which means generosity, which is one of the perfections.
So
how do imperfect beings practice perfection imperfectly?
In fact, it's the first perfection. So there's a donation ball on the counter. A portion of the donation goes to our speakers and to their centers, and a portion goes to the store so that we can continue to offer these events here at Many Rivers Books and Tea on Thursday evening. Each Moment is the Universe is available here, and many other Zen books, and we have like a whole case of Zen books. If you haven't seen it in the past, come visit us sometime, and I look forward to seeing you again at Many Rivers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.